The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Unlike the sands through the hourglass, this next hour is nothing like the other days of your lives. Why? Because here at Skeptically Speaking, we strive to change up the status quo, dive headfirst into the evidence, with the ultimate goal in mind of getting you to participate and question everything. Welcome to the show where we take science and logic, jam it into a blender, and taste the skepticism. Skeptically Speaking starts right now, so take it away, Dez.
Thanks, Sean. I don't know, audience. Do these get worse or better? I can't tell. We have a lovely show ahead. Our feature interview will be on skeptical activism with Tim Farley, creator of the websites What's the Harm and SkepTools. Both sites are designed to give you, the average Jill, the information you need to fight the good skeptical fight. And there won't be a brownie in motion today. He'll be back next week. He most graciously let us take his spot in order to fit in a very special and timely interview. We are pleased to have with us today Brian Mason, leader of the Alberta NDP. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Mason has been very vocal in his opposition to Bill 44. And Bill 44, for anyone who has been hiding under a rock, is the one that proposes to amend the Human Rights, Citizenship, and Multiculturalism Act. And, which would give parents the right to opt their children out of school lessons that deal with religion, sexuality, or sexual orientation. And I would say callers, but there will be no callers again for this show because our system is still down. And so do email in to live@skepticallyspeaking.com or if you're all new school, at Skeptical Radio on Twitter. So, Brian, explain what the government is proposing here.
Well, it's an amendment to the Alberta Human Rights Code. And the one good thing that's in the bill is something we've been calling for, which is to include some language that will actually protect gay people. And this has already been imposed by the Canadian Supreme Court. So it's really just a matter of a formality to amend the legislation in that fashion. But what they've done is to include a whole new section that says if the school ever teaches anything to do with sexual orientation, sexuality, or religion, the school board is required to send notice to the parents in advance. And if the parents send a written objection, then it's the responsibility of the teacher to withdraw the children or to excuse the children from that discussion. Now, that in itself is not much different from what's already there.
Right.
Except the provision now is that if a parent believes that the teacher has failed to do that to their satisfaction, then they can file a human rights complaint, which then, you know, is investigated and so on and may ultimately result in a hearing. So that is a huge change. Instead of going through the normal process where the parent would, if they objected to something, would phone the teacher or the principal, and if they didn't like what the principal said, then they could go to the superintendent and then appeal that up to the minister, which is in place now, they can go straight to a complaint before the Human Rights Commission. And the Premier of Alberta, Mr. Stelmach, when he was asked a question, said, would this include something like the teaching of evolution?
Right.
And he said, yes, that would be up to the parent. So that means now it's the responsibility of the school board or and the teacher to inform parents whenever something like that is going to be discussed. And if they don't do that, then they become subject to a human rights complaint and a whole process there.
Okay. Well, now, what actually could happen with a human rights complaint? What are the repercussions of that?
Well, there could be an investigation. They normally try to resolve them through mediation. Ultimately, you can go through the whole process and you could have a hearing and potentially there could be serious repercussions, including fines and so on.
Okay. So there's been a bit of contradiction between what Stelmach has said and what some of the other people in the Conservative Party have said. Stelmach said that you could pull out a student if the parents didn't want them to hear about evolution. Mm-hmm. But
well, you know, ultimately it will depend on the interpretation of the Human Rights Commission. But what concerned me and has concerned many people is the whole idea that we could get back to the situation 84 years or so after the Scopes Monkey Trial,
exactly,
where teachers could be charged for teaching evolution in the class. And that is a really disturbing and retrograde development. Even if that's not the case, then what's happening then is that if a parent has an objection, it places a real chill on the whole teaching process, and teachers can't engage spontaneity. So for example, if some child was called a fag, mm-hmm, by one of his peers, mm-hmm, the teacher, instead of dealing with that right at the moment and explaining why that was wrong and it was unacceptable and so on, might have to stop and go back and notify some parents, and would then lose the opportunity to teach the class about that and to deal with it in a spontaneous way. So,
how is that even possible to try and structure a class in that way?
Well, I'm not a teacher, but it strikes me as very, very difficult. And in order to try and protect these rights of these particular children and their parents, it affects the education of all the other children in the class. Because you don't have the ability. Teachers are afraid that they're going to be hauled before the Human Rights Commission if they say the wrong thing. It's going to have a very chilling effect on that teacher's ability to interact spontaneously and creatively with the class and deal with teaching moments as they arise.
Well, and this is, you know, evolution isn't the only issue, although it's definitely a primary issue on this show. I don't know if you've been reading everywhere on the internet, this is a huge deal for people. This is all over the world right now. People are up in arms about what the Alberta government is trying to do. So, which is frightening.
Checked out some of the blogs, mm-hmm, and so on in my own Facebook page. You know, mm-hmm, there's been a raging debate about it, and certainly on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's website, there was nearly 2,000 comments on the story.
Really?
When you raised this, yeah.
I noticed when I was commenting on that one myself that as I was reading through the comments, they were filling in quicker than I could go through the pages.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely a heated issue.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
So this doesn't just have relevance to science classrooms and the teaching of evolution. This could be used in any classroom. And some people have brought up, and actually I think on your Facebook status, they've brought up, could kids be pulled out of their class if they were talking about the Holocaust and their parents didn't agree with that? And I definitely understand that a lot of people say that's a lot of exaggeration, but is it?
Well,
in your opinion?
You know, it depends. Certainly, parents who believed, for example, if they were Holocaust deniers and they claimed religious grounds for that, they could initiate a complaint. Absolutely, they could initiate a complaint. How that complaint would be dealt with and whether it would be dealt with reasonably is another question.
So, if a child in the classroom asked a potentially contentious question, the teacher would actually have to stop the class, go phone all the parents.
Potentially, that would be the case. So, if any parent had provided notice under the Act that they wanted their children exempt from any discussion of religion, for example, or sexuality, then you would have to. You'd have to deal with that. And the teachers we talked to, we had a news conference today with a teacher and a retired teacher, and they were absolutely opposed to this particular legislation. See, the question is, why do you make these things rights? Why do you make the right of a child not to learn about sexuality or religion a protected human right under the Human Rights Code? Why don't you, for example, make the freedom of children from bullying a protected right, or the right of a disabled child to have fully accessible school buildings a protected right? Why did they choose these rights And I think the answer has to do with the politics in the conservative government and the conservative caucus, because you have a group there that are I would describe them as a religious right. I would describe them as social conservatives who are gaining strength in the conservative government. Ted Morton is the leader, and he and his followers have been pushing hard inside the conservative caucus for this type of change. He introduced a private members bill in our legislature 2-3 years ago, which was defeated, that had many of the same provisions. And he's managed now to push this through so that you've got the government as a whole, even though some don't support this, are defending it. So Dave Hancock, for example, is the education minister, and we know he doesn't support this, and yet he's forced to defend that in the legislature. Well, I think that Mr. Hancock should have done the honorable thing and resigned rather than adopted the role of the good soldier defending this particular piece of legislation.
Well, see, one of the issues is that this is being presented as almost a parental rights bill.
Yes.
So parents, you know, looking at it from that aspect, should parents have the ability to pull their child from a class that teaches them things that the parents disagree with?
That, I think, depends what it is. In Alberta, the legislation has always recognized the right of a parent to ask that their child be excused if, for example, sex education class is happening, or if the school is teaching religion. And then the process that's been set up for that goes through the school system. And that's generally been accepted. But this takes it to a whole new level. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason that they pushed for this to be included in the Human Rights Code is because it will then have a pervasive effect on the school system in a way that the current situation does not.
Again, listeners, you can email into live@skepticallyspeaking.com or by Twitter at Skeptical Radio.
I do have one question here. I'll just go right with it here. In Alberta, even if one is opposed to blood transfusions, parents may not deny their children the benefit of the transfusion if it's critical to their survival. Social services would step in. Can't one make the argument that intellectually imprisoning one's children is a form of child abuse, placing them at a disadvantage later in life? Or is this ability to indoctrinate your children an informal right?
Well, I'm going to be careful in answering that question. I don't consider it to be child abuse. There are some in our province that believe that the parent has ultimate control over a child, or should have ultimate control over any aspect of their child's education. The question is whether or not that should be imposed in this way in the public school system, and in a way that affects teachers and other students. And that is, I think, the intention of some of the backers of this piece of legislation. They want to erode the role of the public education system in providing a balanced and objective and scientific education for the children.
Plus, too, I know if I was, you know, thinking about going to a career teaching, I'd be a little dissuaded if one of the potential consequences of me saying the wrong thing would be getting thrown in front of the Human Rights Council.
Exactly.
That's quite a bit of a jump from just the normal, you know, normal punishments or whatever you would call it. Yeah. It's quite a leap at that point.
I think that it represents an unwarranted attempt to intimidate teachers on the fronts of religion and sexuality.
I'm assuming that's because I do agree with, you know, parents having rights over what their children are learning, but children also have a right to an education regardless of what their parents' beliefs are. And so this is a terribly troubling law to me. I was also thinking about some of the potential repercussions of this. So if somebody was pulled out of, let's stay with evolution here, if somebody was pulled out of the evolution segment in their science class, and they stayed at home, and all the rest of the students had to learn that subject, would the student that was pulled out still get credit for it? Like, I actually, that's very unfair.
Well,
would it still be on the test?
You're illustrating that really it is quite a can of worms. And the other question is, what do you do with these children, especially in smaller schools, rural schools? Where do they go? Do they sit out in the hallway? Do they go sit in the office for an hour? And what happens when something, you know, just comes up? You have to stop everything.
Well, that's the thing. Has anybody thought about the tangible aspects of this at all?
I don't think they have, and I think that, Dr. Morton, Ted Morton, who's really behind this, has a better understanding. I think in some respects he's a little more sophisticated than some of the others in the Conservative caucus and government, who may not realize the full impact of this over a period of time.
Talking about impact, again, this is honestly, when I heard about this, I was thinking worst case scenario. And I'm still thinking worst case scenario, honestly. How will other provinces view us? Now, I was talking about how we're seen on the internet, and Lord. But one of the things I'm thinking is, when these high school students go to apply for university out of province, are other universities going to be, you know, if they apply for science programs, are Albertans going to be discriminated against to a certain degree? Are you know, administrations officers going to be thinking, or admissions officers rather, going to be thinking, oh, they went to school in Alberta?
Well, I hope not.
Will there
not,
be a survey know? Of some kind? I don't know.
I hope not. I think Alberta continues to have a very good education system.
Absolutely, one of the best.
But we'll have to see, you know, how this affects education in practice in our province. I tell you one thing, it's not good.
To say the least. So I guess, you know, since Stelmach has said something different than Lindsay, I'm sorry, what's his last name?
Lindsay Blacken.
Thank you. Now, since they have opposing viewpoints of what exactly is our how this bill is going to be applied. Is this something that we just sort of have to wait for the lawyers to bring to the table? Like the first person that files a suit of some kind, that lays a human rights complaint, and then we'll figure out how these things are going to be applied?
I think that's really part of the problem. It's not sort of setting out how every case is going to be handled. It's just going to say if you don't do these things and a parent wants to file a complaint before the Human Rights Commission, then it will go through that process. So you're really setting up a system. It's not really jurisprudence, but it's the same sort of thing. So there'll be a whole series of cases. Some of them may find their way ultimately into the courts, and then they'll define a body of case law around this, and you don't know what that's going to look like, but you do know that it's going to significantly change how education is delivered in our province.
Well, on that frightening note,
yeah, we are getting close to the end of our time for this segment here. I had noticed you put up on your the AlbertaNDP.ca website that there's some information on the Bill 44 petition,
yes.
And it has some ways you can help, etc. So we will link to that in the show notes, and for those just wanting to find it right away, it is on albertandp.ca. So,
thank you.
Perfect. Thanks so much for being with us, Brian.
Yes, thank you very much.
And, actually, after the show, I'm also going to post some YouTube videos of Brian bringing this up in the legislature. There's a couple of videos, actually, and they should be called Brian Rips the Conservatives a New One. It was brilliant.
Thanks.
Perfect. So we are going to play a few wee commercials, and then we'll be back with Tim Farley of What's the Harm?
All right. We'll see everyone in a few.
Next week on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about censorship. From Canada Customs to the Broadcast Standards Council to libel, slander, and hate crime legislation, there seems to be a lot of organizations devoted to telling us what we're allowed to do, play, read, and say.
Does this benefit society by protecting our right to an inclusive and just environment? Or should freedom of speech be the most inherent right? We'll be discussing this with Dennis Young, leader of the Libertarian Party of Canada, so this should be interesting. Join us next week on Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m., here on CJSR.
Here at Skeptically Speaking, we have a little slogan. Call in and question everything. Well, due to some technical challenges, we'll be asking you to reach us by email for tonight's show at live@skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also blast us your thoughts via Twitter to our account, Skeptical Radio. After tonight's show, you may comment on our blog at skepticallyspeaking.com. Our show is also available as a podcast on iTunes or also on our website. Again, that email is live@skepticallyspeaking.com. We look forward to getting your thoughts on air. Oh, welcome back, everybody.
You are again listening to Skeptically Speaking. And remember, there are no calls during the show because our phone system is... It's actually been hooked up, but we don't trust it yet. Maybe next week we'll trust it again. It hurt us badly.
It'll take us a while to heal from this.
It will.
Yes.
It will. So if you would like to ask your questions, please do send them into live@skepticallyspeaking.com or at Skeptical Radio on Twitter. So we are here now with Tim Farley. Welcome, Tim.
Oh, hold on. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And you can hear us okay still, right?
Yep.
We were a little concerned at first. Perfect.
So Tim's a software engineer in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's always been a science enthusiast and a bit of a closet skeptic. And he attended the Amazing Meeting in 2007, the amazing meeting that we talk about here all the time. And at that meeting, he decided to get more involved. And so his first...
That's right.
Thank you. That's good. I'm glad your bio's right. his first project was a website called What's the Harm? And why don't we just start off with What's the Harm? That's pretty ambitious for a first skeptical project.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how I got onto that idea, but I started researching stories that were on skeptic websites that people would pass around and talk about people who've been injured by irrational thinking, and I just started collecting them into one file. I'm not quite sure what I was going to do with it, and it eventually evolved into the website.
So tell us what the site looks like now.
We've got about 70 or 80 categories of different things like alternative medical treatments and paranormal things, believing in psychics, various scams, internet misinformation, any sort of thing where one person is pushing misinformation to another. And we try to find documented stories where actual people have gotten injured. For instance, using homeopathy instead of an actual treatment for a disease and then ending up dying or going to the hospital for that disease. And just documenting the cases and linking to the news stories to show that it isn't just an isolated case. There are, you know, literally in some cases, hundreds of people have been hurt by some of these things.
So the entire site is basically like a rebuttal to anyone who says, you know, come on, believing in insert crazy thing here. Why? How is that wrong? It doesn't hurt anybody.
Right. Exactly. What's the harm? You know, that always seemed to be the meme or whatever. You know, what's the harm in it? You know, you claim that homeopathy is just water. Well, if I'm just drinking water, what possible harm could it do to me? And well, the fact of the matter is if you're using that water in place of an actual scientifically proven treatment, it can do a lot of harm to you. And we've got several hundred people in the homeopathy category right now. And a lot of times we find that when you get into debates with people who are pushing paranormal or alternative medicine or any of the sort of things that skeptics deal with, they always offer anecdotes in support of whatever it is they're talking about. And So this gives the skeptics some anecdotes to come back with, basically. And it's not really technically the most logically correct to argue a point, but it can be useful when you have someone who is trying to hit you up with anecdotes. You can hit them back with a few anecdotes of the other side.
Well, and that's I think the only complaint that that I've even remotely seen about your site is that it is anecdotal evidence.
And, yeah, it is.
And it's the same thing that we would say to people who tell us, for example, you know, well, homeopathy cured my brother's friend's mother's cancer.
Right.
So what would you say to those people?
Well, I answer that in the frequently asked questions, and I actually say, yes, you know, these are absolutely just anecdotes, and they don't prove anything. But you have to consider that for the anecdotes that are offered by the other side as well. And, you know, and push both of them down and say, hey, look, you know, we need some science. And the fact of the matter is, for the, you know, alternative medicine in particular, it really sticks in my craw.
Mm-hmm.
There's no science behind a large part of it, and very little science behind some of it. And it's just, you know, it's just a way to get some dialogue going with people, and then maybe push them toward looking into whether the science is there, and
mm-hmm.
and what science is there, and what does it say about homeopathy or acupuncture or whatever.
Well, I envision a conversation, you know, when Betty Jo says, you know, chelation therapy saved my grandma's cat, and you can come back with,
I was about to say cat too.
Oh,
which
nice.
Is, yeah.
See, we are
we
too,
hang out
much
too much
together. Okay. And then you can come back with, oh, okay, well, here's this anecdotal evidence. And by
right.
the way, here's this study. What do you got?
Right.
So I definitely think as a conversation starter, like you're talking about promoting dialogue, I think that's exactly what we're going for with this, right?
Right, and I do try to, and I call them out, and it was a special link on the left-hand side. Whenever I find stuff where there is a scientific study, there's a lot of case reports and things that have been done where they do systematic reviews of case reports and look at a particular thing, like chelation therapy or, you know, homeopathy or whatever, and they go back over the literature and say, well, you know, have there been adverse incidents? And I call those out specifically on a specific page. So if you want to say, okay, well, most of these are just anecdotes from the newspaper, well, you can go to my science page and find stuff where it's been vetted. It was published in a journal.
That's brilliant. Anybody who hasn't been to the site, it's basically lists upon lists of examples of, if you just look at the AE section, you have acupuncture, alpha biotics, alternative dentistry, alternative medicine, applied kinesiology, autism denial, Ayurvedic medicine, and it's kind of depressing, really, especially the page on children.
Yeah, it can be very depressing, especially if you get on the children's page or any of the medical pages where people end up dead. That was kind of one. There were a couple categories I added specifically to sort of lighten it up a little bit, and I leave them as the categories you visit last before you leave the site. And those are the
moon landing.
The moon landing.
Absolutely, the moon landing.
Page, and the GPS navigation systems is somewhat entertaining because no one actually gets killed on that page. They just mess up their cars, usually.
I don't know how you can drive by all those signs that say, you know, stop, the bridge is coming, or no bridge ahead, and
right.
still
it's amazing.
Fall into the lake.
We should talk about the Darwin Awards. But, so, where do you actually get the stories?
People send them to me. I also use some Google tools to scour the there's a thing called a Google alert you can set, and it basically tells the Google search engine when it finds new content that matches a certain search to email you. So I get a ton of emails from Google's robots on Monday morning that I have to cull through and look for the stories. And of course a lot of them aren't really relevant, but every once in a while you find one. And as the site gets more popular, more and more I'm getting people sending me stuff. There were just a couple. Somebody sent me today, sent me one about orgonomy.
I don't know that one.
What's... Orgonomy is really, really weird. There was this Freudian psychiatrist from Austria who moved to the United States, and he developed this theory that all human health related to how many orgasms you have. And further, it had to do with, it was one of these key type things where it was like energy flowing through your body and blah, blah, blah. And he had this whole theory where the energy actually came from the sky and flowed through your body. So he built these boxes that you would sit in to try to concentrate the energy to improve it. And then he became convinced that the clouds would interfere with it. So he built this machine that would break up clouds called Cloudbuster. The guy was just an absolute nut. And there are still institutions that study what this guy did. And one variation of it is these people make these little crystals that they call orgonite that supposedly concentrates this energy. And you keep the crystals near you and it keeps you healthy. Well, there was a story on BBC just yesterday where some folks were going through Africa trying to spread the word of orgonomy to everyone. And they were throwing orgonite crystals into a reservoir, right, so that the energy would be in the water that people were drinking from. Well, the people who are in charge of security for the dam see these people throwing this stuff into the water right by the dam, and they arrested them. It's like, what are you throwing into our reservoir? It's like, oh, no, it's for your health. Yeah, fine, tell it to the judge.
Okay, I do have to clear one thing up. So more orgasms are better.
Oh, yes, I have objection to that.
Okay, good. I haven't heard of that one at all. That's new. Yeah. That's new.
It's a fun one. And what's fun is if you get into skepticism for a while, you'll notice like crossovers between different types of skepticism. Like the UFO guys will get into conspiracy theory stuff and things like that. Well, the orgonomy people have gotten latched onto by the chemtrails people. The chemtrails
people. Really?
The guys that believe that all these jets that are flying over are actually spraying chemicals to mind control us and whatnot. Because Wilhelm Reich invented this Cloudbuster machine, the chemtrails people are all suddenly fascinated with it, right?
Wow.
They think that maybe they can use the Cloudbuster machine to break up the chemtrails before they, hypnotize them. So if you go to the sites, you go to the chemtrail sites, you'll see mentions of orgonite and cloudbusters and stuff. And it's like, wow, these are so two completely unrelated things that got pulled together by just sheer nuttiness.
But
it's hilarious.
I'm sure you're aware of the studies that have been done that show, once you believe in one conspiracy theory or a rational belief, you are much more likely to believe in more.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating.
And that's just just one of the great pieces of evidence for that.
Wow, you are on the cutting edge of crazy, crazy research. Congratulations.
I end up reading a lot of really weird news stories.
So, let's move on to SkepTools, because I find this site fascinating. Would you consider SkepTools sort of an extension of What's the Harm?
Yeah, it was kind of an extension of the fact that I realized when I did What's the Harm, I didn't really expect it to go too far. In fact, I thought skeptics were going to object to it because of the whole, anecdotal evidence
thing. Right.
But actually, it took off like a shot and people loved it. So then I started thinking, well, maybe I can, more generically help people to build other things like this because I'm a software developer. And so I started thinking about, well, what other things could you do? And I don't necessarily have time to do them all myself. So I thought, well, maybe I can help teach other people to do it, and people can come up with other types of specialized skeptic websites to solve specific problems of skepticism. Because what I was seeing is that there's a lot of people who decide that, oh, I want to do something in skepticism, so they just do kind of the same thing everybody else is doing. They set up a blog or they set up a podcast, and they just try to attack the whole thing at once. And it seems like we've got a lot of that already. What we need is more specialization. We need people to look into things like ergonomy and be the expert in ergonomy or whatever, or be the expert in chemtrails.
I wouldn't mind being the expert a little bit in that field, but
well, there was an interesting thing actually in ergonomy. The guy died in 1957, and supposedly it gets repeated on all the ergonomy websites that his papers were stored away at some university until 50 years after his death. Well, that just happened like a year and a half ago, that anniversary. So somewhere in a university are a bunch of boxes of papers that some skeptic could go request access to,
Sean,
and do some really cool research and, put up a skeptic website that reveals the true craziness that was this guy.
All right, Tim, I'm going to jump into a question here. You mentioned internet activism quite a bit, but one of the problems with the internet is that there's something there for everyone. If you're someone who believes your goldfish controls your destiny, you can probably find an online support group that thinks the same thing. Is there any way to reach those people through the internet, perhaps through wiki lobbying, as you discuss on your blog? Or do we have to accept the fact that in the information age, the information age will breed new life into the most bizarre beliefs?
Well, that is true, that no matter what category of crazy belief there is some website for it, and probably three websites and two forums that argue with each other about it. And it can be hard to reach people. I'm kind of the opinion that I don't really want to reach the true believers anymore, because it's hard to convince people once they've convinced themselves. You know, they get so locked into their little belief that, you know, no matter how much logic you throw at them, they're not going to listen. And so what I'm more interested in is catching the people who are on the edge, people who might be talking to one of those believers, not necessarily a believer themselves. I want to catch them before they get drawn in to that and convince them not to get drawn into it. So that's what I'm aiming at. I mean, and you can try to reach the believers. I think the key is to use sites like Wikipedia, like Twitter, like Facebook, where everybody is. Because if you try to go on the skeptic sites, of course, the skeptics hang out there, and
you're preaching to the converted, so to speak.
Right, you're preaching to the converted, and if you go to the believer sites, a lot of times they'll just ban you out of the forum because they don't want to hear your skeptical arguments. So the kind of neutral websites are a good place to have these discussions, and because, you know, it's neutral ground. And you can at least lead people to sites like What's the Harm or whatever that they can learn a little bit more about it.
Well, you were actually talking quite a bit on SkepTools about how to reach the neutral people. You did mention Wikipedia. How exactly can people use that to reach the neutrals? Sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead.
What we're trying to do is there's a few of us, well, actually there's quite a number of people who are skeptics who try to edit Wikipedia and make sure that, you know, believer material doesn't get inserted into places that it doesn't belong. So like articles about alternative medicine make sure that it has a neutral point of view. Wikipedia has an official policy of having a neutral point of view. So in theory, the believer shouldn't be able to take over their articles and make them very slanted, but in practice sometimes it happens, so it pays for skeptics to try to get in there and try to simply get links to skeptic sites put in there just to lead people out. I was talking to the webmaster of skeptic.com, the Skeptic Society website, and he said he was looking at his logs and he said an amazing number of their inbound traffic actually comes from Wikipedia.
That's promising.
Yeah, because skeptic.com is linked in a lot of different articles, Michael Shermer's biography and various other places, and people click those links and then find better content.
Well, one of the things I like about SkepTools is the fact that you have, you know, really easy ways for people to get involved, all the way up to advanced ways. And one of the easy ways that I thought was fantastic was Amazon's affiliate program. I've never thought about this. Can you explain that?
Yeah, there's actually, Amazon's had this program since you know, forever since Amazon existed practically. And basically you can put up links to, and you can, if you click on store on What's the Harm, you can see my Amazon store. You can have links to good skeptical books on your skeptical website. But here's the thing. If you buy a book from those Amazon links on What's the Harm, I get 20 cents or, 12 cents or something like that. It depends on what the book is and da-da-da-da-da. There's all these different rules. But I get a small amount of money. You don't pay anything different than you would have paid if you had bought it on Amazon.com, but a little bit of the marketing budget of Amazon gets diverted to me. And so I have that on What's the Harm. There's a whole bunch of other skeptical websites that have that on their sites. And so basically the simple advice is that if you're already buying stuff from Amazon.com, before you type Amazon.com into the browser and go to buy something, go to a skeptical site and follow an Amazon link from there, and then buy your item, and then the skeptical site is going to get, $1.50 or 7 cents or whatever it is, and those things add up. And so that's a way of basically donating money to good skeptical organizations and websites with no extra effort on your part. You're paying exactly the same thing to Amazon that you would have paid, but Amazon pays the affiliate fee back to the skeptical website.
And this is the stuff I like. I like stuff that's not time intensive for me, because this show is time intensive enough. But for the people,
and if you go to my article on that on skeptools.com, I list all the different skeptical websites that I know of that have Amazon affiliate things. So if you don't want to give money to What's the Harm, you can find one of the other skeptical organizations to use their Amazon link.
So you also cover a bunch of other techniques, from how to get your own skeptical news more effectively, using certain software, to making your website more accessible to people who are searching for specific things.
Right.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about some of those? Because Google mapping. Sorry, what was it? Geomapping? That was the word.
Yeah, geomapping. Yeah, this was all stuff that came out of, the whole idea for SkepTools came out of a presentation that I gave at TAM last year, TAM 6, which was about building internet tools and using kind of the Web 2.0 technologies. And one of the things that I do is I when you have content that has some sort of geographic association with it, like my cases on What's the Harm, all of those things happen somewhere in the world, right, in some city. So I mark them up in a way in the HTML so that Google and the other search engines can see in basically HTML coding where these things are, and they can put them on a map. And the idea is that if you go to Google Maps and you or any of the other mapping programs, you can click links and see content from Flickr and YouTube and other types of content, and it will show up in the map mixed in with stuff that Google put there. So this is a way for skeptics, if you have things like, for instance, maybe you wrote an article debunking a local homeopath or psychic in your town. Make sure that article is marked up so that Google recognizes where that homeopath's office is. And then, in theory, it's possible that your web article will appear when the person is sitting there in Google Maps trying to find out how to drive to the homeopath's office.
And again, this is reaching the neutral parties.
Right. That's the idea, is to try to reach. It doesn't always work as easily. The most obvious example I've seen that works really well is if you do YouTubes, there's a way when you upload a YouTube to associate a location on Earth with it. So if you're doing any sort of protesting against anything, and in particular the anonymous people who protest Scientology have done this, where they post YouTubes of their protest and then mark it where the Scientology office was that they were protesting at. And then when you go in Google Maps, if you have the YouTube layer turned on, boom, you're sitting there saying, oh, how do I get to the Scientology office? All these little YouTube icons appear next to it. And you go, hey, what's this YouTube icon? And you click on it, and hopefully you'll see some information about why Scientology is bad.
Well, the geotagging somewhat reminds me of kind of the Twitter phenomenon of the hashtags, where you post an article or a story relating to your locality, and you might mark it. In Edmonton, we use the term YEG, YEG, just our airport code. And, people watch... Sorry?
I was just looking that up this morning because I saw that in one of the tweets, and it's like, what is YEG? And I looked it up and said, oh, okay, I get it.
Not as interesting as it could be.
Yeah, it's one of those things that picked up locally. There's some debate, but it's what's taken off. A lot of the Canadian cities actually, for some reason, use their airport codes. It's kind of what we do.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. But
I fly into Ottawa a lot, so I knew the codes up there were all Y.
Yeah. So
all began with Y.
So that's a great way if you're posting again an article or you even want to give some, you know, some insight on something locally, you're posting it on Twitter, you throw in some relevant hashtags such as your city's tag, and then, you know, it pops up for all those people who track it. So not a bad way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm gonna switch gears here actually to the What's the Harm. We got an email in from somebody that wanted to say bravo to you for setting up the website, and she does ask to link permission to link to you, but I'll get to that privately. When people ask what's the harm in believing in unfounded things, I tell them my story. I took herbal remedies when I was 22 years old. I thought I was making an informed decision. I read up on what I was taking and was referred by somebody who had been seeing the herbalist for 10 years, and he had been business for 25 years, etc. But my ignorance was that the herbal remedies and health foods were not regulated. My mistake cost me my health and nearly my life. Each day I live with my consequences. I've used my experience to educate people, including pharmacy and medical students here at the University of Alberta. And the saying, your sole purpose may be to serve as a warning to others, hits close to home for me. She just followed up with, many people believe in foolish things based on anecdotal claims, so why not take those kind of claims into account as a rebuttal as well? Please pass on my appreciation to Tim for his great work.
Yeah, that is a huge problem, the fact that herbal remedies are not properly regulated. I've got a number of cases from Canada and from the United States where people have taken herbal remedies and not realized that there were heavy metals or even prescription drugs that were doped into the herbal remedy to try to boost its effectiveness. And then there's a side effect and somebody ends up dead. And It's an interesting problem for skeptics because there are some herbal remedies that actually have some science behind them, but there's a whole lot of them that don't. So you have to kind of take it on a case-by-case basis when somebody says, well, I'm taking herbal blank for this. Well, you got to look it up. You know, is it useful for that?
And that's the thing, though. We do have the internet. And, you know, someone like Sean is, you know, he's a programmer. I, on the other hand, do not have those skills. I just sort of hand my computer to people and make it work. You, yes. But the thing is, anybody can do this kind of research, and it requires not all that much research when it comes right down to it.
Right. But you have to be careful because it's very easy to find somebody who can put up a website and claim that, oh, we're selling herbal whatever, and here's our study or here's our scientific study, and it'll turn out that the scientific study was done by the company itself and only had 14 patients in it and whatnot. So you have to kind of be able to dig deep and read some of the details and understand what they're saying. If you can read the scientific language that they use, the Cochrane Collaboration website is an excellent way to check on scientific evidence. They do these retrospective reviews where they look over the literature and try to come up with a final answer of, you know, is this, you know, is acupuncture recommended for this malady? And here are the 14 studies that have been done, and in our considered opinion, the answer is no, or whatever. And they're doing new ones all the time.
Well, see, maybe that's, you know, you have a lot of different ideas actually on the site about different projects that people can get involved with. Maybe that's one. Maybe setting up a site that helps people learn how to read studies. That's lovely. Because it seems like that's a huge problem. People don't understand the concept of peer reviewed or sample sizes, for example. But anyway, there's actually, just staying on that, some of the ideas that you had were great. And I just, do you want to just give a brief kind of description of the things you're talking about? You suggested a who's who in woo-woo?
Yeah. Yeah, that was in my, you know, one of the things I've been harping on with people is to try, like I said before, is to specialize. You know, if you're a skeptic, skepticism, and this is kind of a mistake I made in What's the Harm, is that I have so many different categories that I've got so much stuff to track that it becomes too time consuming. But I think skeptics should specialize. And that can be specializing on your local area and being an activist in your town, or it can be specializing in a particular subject, be it orgonomy or numerology or whatever. But be that, you know, specialist and dig deep. And then, you know, if you want to put up a website, then you can put up a specialized website. Or if you want to write a book or an article or whatever it is, but do whatever it is that you feel is in your wheelhouse. But yeah, who's who in woo-woo? Just an idea of having a list of, you know, who are all the psychics in the world that are currently active. I see a lot, if you follow the skeptical forums, you see people popping up on the forums saying, hey, I just saw an ad for, you know, Frank Jones, who's going to be at my local auditorium giving psychic readings. Does anybody know about this guy's history? Where is he from? You know, is he a scammer? Is he a TV guy? You know, where did he come from? And it would be nice if we had a site that had all those details just in one place. You know, everybody knows the famous people like Sylvia Brown and John Edward or whatever, but there's thousands of other people going around from town to town, literally pushing snake oil or psychic readings or whatever it is.
You also suggested a skeptical wiki.
Yeah, well, there is a skeptical wiki. It's a skeptic wiki, I think. And let me double check that.
I haven't seen that at all.
Skepticwiki.com, I think, is it? No, that's not it.
Well, if we track it down, we can always post the link.
Yeah, but it's skepticwiki.org, and it's a wiki for skeptical topics, and they have a way, I believe, that you can volunteer. I think they try to – it's not quite as open as Wikipedia, because obviously you'd have all the woo-woos coming in and altering stuff, but you can email – the guy, and he will give you an account, and you can start filling things in. And that would be an excellent place to be doing the who's who of woo-woo. Just start having – they do have a people section, and start writing articles about some of these people and tracking where they're going and what they're doing and whether or not they've been tested and et cetera, so that when they go to a new town, people can have that information to work with.
Right.
Maybe what we need is something like a skeptical social network, kind of a Facebook for skeptics. Some way we can, you know, put the message out there that, you know, that,
yeah,
hey, I'm looking for an expert in this. This person's coming to town. What can we do? Who knows about this?
Yeah, well, there's actually quite a lot of that is being done on Facebook and on Twitter. There's been a lot of skeptical activity on Twitter just in the last few months.
Absolutely.
We like to think we help contribute to that.
I think you did. Yeah. I think you did, and I encourage people to follow me on Twitter. I'm K-R-E-L-N-I-K, Krelnik. You can follow me, and I send little skeptical updates every morning of the historical events that happen on that day that relate to skepticism. And but, yeah, you can reach people through that. In fact, somebody was looking for a guest for their podcast just this afternoon, and I sent that along to somebody that I knew on the CDC, at the CDC. So, yeah, all sorts of networking can be done.
Absolutely. I don't think that people are taking Twitter seriously enough yet, but they will. I've made some wonderful connections with people on Twitter.
Yeah. And absolutely.
I think it's one of the great things about it is that it's 140 characters maximum.
I can
make that kind of commitment.
Yeah, there's a big we were just talking the other day, some folks and I were talking about the too long didn't read syndrome.
Right. I know that one.
Where people write these giant long messages on forums and people just say TLDR, too long, didn't read it. And it does seem to be prone to skeptics like to talk and like to make their point very thoroughly. And Twitter forces you to be like super spare and get right to the point. And it's good that way.
Love it. That's actually one of the only places I get my news lately, because all of the people that I like reading their blogs, they tweet. So
right.
I know I don't even have to go to their blogs anymore. I just click the link. It's brilliant. It has saved me so much time and actually sucked part of my life away. So maybe that's a trade-off.
Right. But, it's great. I mean, essentially, the people you're following act as a set of editors. That are looking for good content. When you see them sending links, you say, well, they thought it was good. Maybe I should go read that.
So your whole experience with skepticism started at The Amazing Meeting, and now you lead workshops there, which is lovely. It's like the circle of activism is complete.
That's right, yeah. I'm going to be doing a workshop in Skepticism 101, I think is the official title, but I'll be talking about all the things that I'm talking about here at The Amazing Meeting this July in Las Vegas. If you go to randi.org, randi.org, all the details are there about how you can go to that event.
Actually, we have Phil Plait coming on in a couple of weeks.
Oh, Phil's great.
And so I'm sure he'll talk a lot more about that as well.
Absolutely. You won't be able to stop him.
Looking forward to that. And actually, Sean and myself will definitely be at TAM, so we will see everybody there.
Yeah, we went from pretty much zero from Edmonton. Now we have this contingent of at least a dozen or so far coming just from the city here. So we're
cool.
Things are moving forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we do. We always have a group photo of everyone from the JREF forum, and last year there was a group photo just from the people from Colorado. And now you guys will have to do a group photo when you're at TAM, the Edmonton.
Oh, we may make T-shirts. Honestly,
oh,
we are nerds.
No,
we're nerds. Okay, but that's actually all the time we have today. Thank you so much, Tim, for being our guest.
Yeah, we definitely appreciate it.
No problem.
And a big thanks to Brian Mason, leader of the Alberta NDP, for his interview earlier in the show. And thanks also to the people who sent in emails. Hopefully we'll have the phone lines up again next week. So see you all next week on Skeptically Speaking.
And just a reminder to check out the blog at skepticallyspeaking.com.
America doesn't exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. The hippies are working for the government.
And everything
you believe is a lie.
Tiny dwarfs inside your TV.
And nobody cares when you cry.
Your mother resents you. She wanted a girl.
And everything you believe is a lie. You
and I never will,
though I've tried.
We'll never get married.
I'm dating your sister,
and everything you believe.
everything.